From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. At the age of 84, Maggie Kuhn is losing some of her eyesight, but she hasn't lost her sense of purpose. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the founder of the Grey Panthers, who says old people shouldn't be treated like wrinkled babies. Harry Anderson says he's banned from playing cards in Nevada, but they let him wear a judge's robes on TV's Night Court. Coming up, we hear about a few hustles from one of the masters. Also today, Bugs, Daffy, and Hitler. Ken Tucker reviews a collection of Warner Brothers war cartoons now out on home video. And we have some rhythm and blues in our weekly performance spot with pianist Marsha Ball. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Perhaps one of the worst ways I could introduce Maggie Kuhn would be to say she's 84 years young. I suspect she would think of that as very patronizing. Kuhn knows she's not young, and she's very proud of her age and what she's achieved in the past 84 years. Maggie Kuhn has probably done more than any single American to challenge our stereotypes of older people and how we so often condemn them to obsolescence. In 1970, Maggie Kuhn turned 65 and was forced to retire from her job with the United Presbyterian Office of Church and Society, where she was program coordinator in the Division of Church and Race. Sorry to be forced to give up her work, she formed the Grey Panthers with several other retired friends. The vision was of an intergenerational movement that would work to stop ageism and that would campaign on behalf of peace and social justice. The Grey Panthers now have more than 80,000 members around the United States, and Kuhn has been honored with numerous awards for her work. She's now the national convener of the Grey Panthers. Maggie Kuhn, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to Fresh Air.
And it's a pleasure to be with you, Terry. I love your show.
Oh, thank you. What are some of the ways that you think older people are patronized by people who mean well?
Well, we become wrinkled babies instead of the elders of the tribe. And we are isolated. In fact, the Older Americans Act codifies age segregation. There's senior centers and senior services. And the RARE Center puts old and young people together and does not violate the continuum that life is. We're all aging, and the aging process begins with the moment of birth. And it continues till rigor mortis.
What advice would you give us all about expressions that sound like they're really flattering, but are, like, really insulting? Do you know what I mean?
Well, you see, I think we've, with senior centers, or seniors, mm-hmm. and teenagers, I like to think of ourselves as older Americans. And I call myself an old woman.
What's wrong with senior?
Instead of senior. That's a euphemism. It's denial, in my view. But, of course, it's caught on so widely, and it's hard to get it out of the language.
Now, you started the Grey Panthers in 1970 when you faced mandatory retirement. Yeah. How did you feel when you had to give up your job?
I was very depressed and sad because I loved what I was doing. And the mandatory retirement rule I tried to avert, but it was not possible. It was pretty rigid, particularly for women. And so with five of my friends who were in the same predicament, we organized the Consultation for Older and Younger Adults for Social Change. And a television producer in New York said, "You're never going to get anywhere with that name. You're the Grey Panthers." And we said, "Wow, that's for us." And the Black Panthers and the Grey Panthers had close collaborative efforts in those days. And we decided that the issue that we were going to take on was the war in Vietnam, to stand with the draft resistors, to demonstrate in front of the draft boards. That's what we did. And that gave us an immediate entree to young people.
Well, it was interesting. When you started the Grey Panthers in 1970, it was the height of the youth movement.
Yes.
So I think it must have been a challenging time to unite older and younger people.
It was, but around the issue of the war in Vietnam, there was an immediate response.
It was 20 years ago that you started the Grey Panthers. You've changed since then. I mean, you're getting older since then.
Yes.
And what is your health like now?
My health is not as robust as I would like it to be. I have arthritis in both knees and in my hands, and I have great difficulty walking sometimes. I use a cane, and this makes me a member of what the French call l'âge troisième. You know what the third age is. When you can't get along on two legs, you need a third leg. The cane is my third leg.
Do you have to pace yourself differently now than you did a few years ago?
I do, yes. But I have an idea that, in fact, I've tested this in my own life and in the lives of my contemporaries, that when one has a goal, a purpose for living, that we can do a lot of things that we could not do without a goal. And we are reinforced by our own history. We have self-esteem, kind of a sturdy self-esteem, because we've been through a lot of changes. And we're not going to be too worried about them because we'll be able to cope with them.
I'm wondering if you ever feel like you have to push yourself past the point that you'd like to prove something to all the people who admire you so much and who look up to you and to look to you as a role model.
Well, it's an enormous challenge, Terry. And it's humbling, too, because I can't do all that I would like to do. And it may be expected of me. But it seems imperative now in our organization to build a strong intergenerational movement to involve large numbers of young people who will carry on when those of us who are old in the movement become too frail and die. So if we're going to survive and continue to be advocates and to work for social change, peace, and justice, we have to reach out.
I'm wondering if you are angry at certain physical ailments that you have, or
yes,
if you just feel like, well, that's part of getting older. I mean, what's your emotional response to it?
I'm ambivalent about it. I'm glad I've survived, and I'm eternally grateful and privileged and blessed that I'm able to do what I can do. But I do get really frustrated and angry that I can't get up without getting dizzy, that if I forget my cane, I'm in bad shape. And those physical difficulties have to be overcome and dealt with and lived with. And I have to deal with my anger and submerge it to a goal that I believe in that is affirming and hopeful, and move on from there.
I read in the Philadelphia Inquirer that about 2 years ago, you were mugged in your neighborhood. This is a fear a lot of older people have. Everybody has the fear of being mugged, but I think older people are more afraid that they're going to be a target because
yes,
they'll be perceived as very vulnerable. I think
yes,
your purse was snatched.
Yeah.
And you were knocked down. You had a broken shoulder and some facial bruises. You recovered physically from that. What about psychologically? As an older person, were you more afraid to walk the streets, and how did you overcome that fear?
I was really afraid, and the mugging occurred in my neighborhood. I was on my way with one of my housemates to our neighborhood association meeting, three doors from where I live, and it made me worried about the neighborhood. I have twinges in my head when I go past that place. Although I dealt with it at the time, you just move on. But that shock lingers.
So are you more afraid to walk the streets now?
Well, I don't do it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't do it alone because of my difficulty walking.
Right.
Which is one response. I used to do a lot of walking, and I can't do that anymore. I miss it. And part of it is fear of my own infirmity, and also fear of attack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I'm just convinced that we've got to find ways in which the young people in our society have a new future and are not involved in drugs and are not involved in purse snatching and mugging to sustain themselves.
Mm-hmm. Maggie Kuhn is my guest. She's the founder of the Grey Panthers. You were never married, never had children. Now, this is a fear that a lot of people have, growing old alone. And I'm sure that one of the things people look to their children for is companionship and support when they get older. Now that you're older yourself, do you have any regrets about that? And
when people ask me why I never married, I say, I just was very lucky. Because I had a number of great love affairs, which I've enjoyed remembering and writing about. And I have a family of choice that has been a part of my life. And for the last almost 30 years, I've shared my house with a variety of young people. Many of them have been students. And some have lived with me for a long time.
You know, I'm sure it was very unusual within your generation to remain intentionally single and
yes.
without children.
Yes.
Now, this is a position that many, many more men and women are choosing now. So a lot of people are looking ahead to choices very similar to the ones
yes.
that you made
yes.
a long time ago. And that's why I'm kind of interested in what your life as an older person has been like, single and without children. I think a fear that a lot of people have is that if they're living with a family of choice, as you describe it, that they'll feel more like a burden on them if they take ill or if they have certain physical problems than they would feel with someone who is part of
yes.
the family. Has that been a problem?
No, it has not. And people come to live with me understanding that may be the situation. And last year when I had surgery and pneumonia, my housemates were most loving and kind. And Marilyn Vowles, who is my assistant, is also a housemate. And she's a loving friend. We have all kinds of joys that we share. And it is the basis of our closeness that there is shared interest. That's a prerequisite. And also, there has to be space. Each of us has our private space, and there is public space or shared space. And that works very well.
I think a question that a lot of people who also don't have children will have is, were you ever sorry that you didn't have children? And you're always sorry about what you didn't do, everything you do in life. You could have had an alternative
yes,
and done something
yes,
else.
Yes, yes.
But some of those regrets are so deep that
yes.
that you really wish you'd made a different choice. And others you just live with.
And I have just lived with that, Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have children of my own, but I have other children who are mine by choice. I'm very much interested in the young people of our neighborhood and the babies of the young children of former housemates. They mean a great deal to me. And that contents me and gives me joy.
Maggie Kuhn is my guest. 20 years ago, she founded the Grey Panthers, a group that now has 80,000 members. She is the national convener of the group, and we'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Maggie Kuhn, the founder of the Grey Panthers, is my guest. I'm sure you have friends who are your age who have been less fortunate than you in either their health or in their home situation. I mean, I think not everybody is as lucky to find people who they feel great companionship with. You've probably had friends who you've had to visit at convalescent homes and senior citizen homes. What do you think about when you go to a nursing home to visit a friend?
It's depressing. And they're so isolated. There are no young people around. And we need young people to be in our lives. And I have more young friends than old friends. Many more. And most of the women my age, outside of the Grey Panthers, have no contact with young people.
I think that some older people choose to live in age-segregated communities.
Yes.
Do you disapprove of that? I mean, it's their choice.
It's their choice, and they should make their choice. But it seems to me that by building more retirement homes, we are increasing the isolation, the social and political isolation of older Americans. And it seems to me that that is going to deprive our society because we need their input. And when they are institutionalized, there is very little input.
Do you ever go through a crisis of how responsible you should be toward friends who have health problems and can't really take care of themselves? And I ask you this because everybody has to go through this, whether it's with family or with friends. How much of your time you will put into making their lives a little better, and how much of your time you'll need to keep for yourself? And you have such a busy schedule. I mean, you're kind of in demand around the world. So I imagine these have been some tough choices for you.
That's a very perceptive comment and question. It is a choice. And I'm not physically able. I don't drive anymore, which is hardship.
Yeah.
If you've driven for a long time and not to have your own wheels, you are isolated to some degree. But I have loving friends who help me drive. But I keep in touch with people as I can by telephone. And there's some people whom I call regularly, and we chat. The phone is a lifeline in many ways. And I just hope and pray that people understand my situation, my predicament, that I can't go to see them.
There were probably times, too, when you might have been too busy.
Yes.
And then you have to decide what's more important, an organization of 80,000 people that you had,
yes,
or an individual friend who needs you. And these are impossible choices.
Impossible. And there's always a conflict. You're never quite comfortable with the choices that you have to make.
Have you made the choices in both directions?
Yes. That's our human predicament, isn't it?
Maggie Kuhn is my guest, the founder of the Grey Panthers. Many people are very afraid of aging. Have you ever been afraid of getting older?
A bit. I don't lie about my age. I brag about it. But I am afraid of further physical deterioration and the lack of ability to speak, to read. I have failing vision. And there is a gradual deterioration of physical structure. But fortunately, my mind is still alert.
Is that what scares you the most, though, the thought of
losing
some of your mental
mind,
faculties?
Yes. And one of the reasons why I'm very concerned about mental health and the new healthcare system is that we need to know right along, physicians and all the other people in the health field need to know about the way in which bodies age and the way in which certain diseases, if not detected and treated, will result in irreversible brain damage. Now, that's inexcusable. We need to know. And when you think that more people are living longer than any time in human history, that you've got increasing numbers of people in their 90s and into their hundreds, we've got to find new ways in which we can maintain the maximum health, holistic health of the body, the mind, and the spirit, until closure.
Do you have a living will?
Yes, I do.
Describe what it is.
A living will is something that I think everyone should have, people of all ages. There are many accidents that take people's lives when they're young. The living will is that you agree with your priest or rabbi or pastor and your lawyer and your physician that you want no extraordinary means used to extend your life when it's clear that closure should come. In my brother's case, I had to fight in one of the teaching hospitals for his right to die. With the super technology that there is to extend life, it's very tempting to hook people up to another machine. But we need to be wise in planning for our closure and decide when we are in our right minds that we want it to end.
What other planning have you done like that?
Well, I have a will, not only a living will, but an actual will. And I'm willing my two houses, one to the Grey Panthers, one to shared housing. I've planned for people to take some of the furniture that there that I've loved and that they might like. And I'm making that a condition of my will, that so-and-so is going to get the sofa and so-and-so is going to get the chair that was in Grandma's front parlor. And that's fun to do, to plan how the things that you've enjoyed and lived with and that you've inherited can be passed on, not just sold out of hand at some auction.
Do you consider it morbid to talk about things like that?
No,
or really necessary to talk about it?
Necessary. And I think that other people should think of that, too, that it's part of long-range planning. We can plan for our closure. I've even decided in my will who should conduct the memorial service and where. And I want it to be the service itself. I want to be in Morris Arboretum.
Oh, it's beautiful.
With the trees and the flowers that I love. Isn't that a great idea?
Oh, it's beautiful there. It's a wonderful, yes.
And one of my special friends is on the board there, and it'll be such a nice place for people to come.
Do you find that you can talk to younger people about subjects like death as easily as older people?
Not always.
Yeah.
Not always. And you can't always talk to older people about it.
Well, sometimes you don't know how to react when somebody brings
right.
it up. You don't know if they want to be reassured that, what are you talking about? That's not going to happen. Or whether they really want to talk about something that's been on their mind. And you don't know what your response should be, you know?
That's precisely the case. There's a denial of age and aging and a denial of closure. It's part of life.
In all the thinking that you've had to challenge, you know, about the stereotypes we have in older people, and I'm sure you've had to challenge the thinking of a lot of older people, too.
Yes, I have. And I think there has been some reassessment in their lives. And one of the things that is a public acclamation and affirmation is the celebration of Older Americans Month.
Which is this month, it's May.
Which is this month.
What does that mean to you?
It means something very special. And I'm delighted that there is affirmation publicly across the country and in particular communities of what it means to get old. And that here's a group that not isolated, but that is still a part of the mainstream and still having something to contribute.
In challenging stereotypes and so on, have you been on a campaign to convince older people that their retirement can be different from their preconceptions of retirement?
We have said that retirement is not retirement, but regrouping. It's non-retirement for something from a job that you might not have liked, but it is moving into a new kind of concern and advocacy that is affirming and energizing and contributory to peace and justice in our society.
You like to do something outrageous every week. What are some of the outrageous things you've done in the past couple of years?
Well, I've fired a lot of telegrams to Ronnie Reagan. And some of them were great telegrams, but I never got anything back.
What's an example? What did you say?
I've never heard from him.
Uh-huh.
Maybe his staff protected him from my outrage. But we sent a Valentine to President Bush. It was a very large Valentine. And this was the content of it. It was packed in a big, big box, about 5 feet square, beautifully decorated with red hearts. And in it was an empty plate for the hungry, a package of sparklers for the 1,000 points of light. You know, sparklers don't last very long. They go out quickly. A gold-plated toilet seat and wrench for the Pentagon. We made those and decorated them with gilt paper. A bag of 50 pennies for the deficit, you understand, and a home sweet home sampler to go inside the box, which was to house a homeless person.
Did you get any response?
For a long time we didn't, but last week we got the pennies back.
How come?
There was a little note, a form letter about 4 feet, mm-hmm. 4 inches mm-hmm. in diameter, that said, we're not permitted to accept monetary contributions at the White House. We're returning your pennies. So we got them back. We knew that somebody got the Valentine, and we were glad. Now we're dreaming up what we can send to Mr. Bush on Independence Day. We've got a committee working on that. But we're going to remember him and nudge him on every holiday.
Maggie Kuhn, I thank you very, very much for talking with us today. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, Terry.
Maggie Kuhn is the founder of the Gray Panther. She's 84 and still actively involved with the organization as the national convener of the group. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a trip around the equator with travel writer Thurston Clark, author of the book Equator. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Harry Anderson used to run a shell game. Then he turned his con games into street performance and a club act. But he thinks his biggest hustle was landing the role of the judge on TV's Night Court. Coming up, we meet swindler and actor Harry Anderson. Also, we hear how Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck helped the war effort. Ken Tucker reviews a collection of Warner Brothers' World War II cartoons, now out on home video. And pianist Marshall Ball plays some rhythm and blues in our weekly performance spot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Iran's parliament speaker today urged Palestinians to declare open war on American interests throughout the world. Hashemi Rafsanjani, shown on Iranian TV leaning on an AK-47 assault rifle, suggested Palestinians blow up factories in Western countries and attack planes in retaliation for Palestinian deaths in the Israeli-occupied territories. The Bush administration reacted angrily to Rafsanjani's statements. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler.
The outrageous call to murder and terrorism by Iran's Speaker of the Parliament, Rafsanjani, marks another step backward for Iran, away from the community of civilized nations. So long as the support of terrorism remains an instrument of Iranian policy, the Iranian government will guarantee its isolation and the continuing hardships of the Iranian people.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the U.S. would hold Iran responsible for any attacks on American interests or citizens. Britain ordered the expulsion of three South African diplomats today. The action was a show of protest over South Africa's supply of arms to Protestant extremists in Northern Ireland in exchange for weapons secrets. South Africa reportedly supplied Kalashnikov rifles, grenade launchers, handguns, and other materiel to the extremists in return for information on the blowpipe ground-to-air missile manufactured in Belfast. The expulsions came despite an apology from South African President P.W. Botha to British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. A 13-year-old Palestinian was killed today during a clash with Israeli troops in Bethlehem. The army said the boy was shot after he joined a group of youths hurling rocks and iron bars at a military observation post. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir paid a hospital visit today to three Israelis wounded in a stabbing incident on Wednesday. A Palestinian man was arrested for the Jerusalem attack, which killed two other Israelis. Comments Shamir made during his visit have been criticized as an invitation to Israelis to take the law into their own hands. The BBC's Gerald Butt reports.
Mr. Shamir went to the hospital in Jerusalem where the injured are being treated. He denied that the security situation in the country was getting worse. He said it was up to people, as he put it, to defend themselves from such attacks, and then when the perpetrators had carried out their foul deeds, to make sure that they didn't come out in one piece. Mr. Shamir didn't elaborate, but his remark has already drawn criticism from left-wing politicians here. One said it could only be interpreted as encouragement for the public to take the law into their own hands. A spokesman for Mr. Shamir said later, though, what the Prime Minister had meant was simply that people shouldn't let perpetrators escape from the scene of a crime. At the time of last Wednesday's stabbing, the attacker, when he was caught, had to be protected by the police from an angry crowd who were demanding that he be lynched.
The BBC's Gerald Butt in Jerusalem. Kidnappers in Lebanon today released two West German hostages and said the life of a third is in danger unless Cyprus releases an unidentified prisoner. The two freed West Germans, a doctor and nurse working for a relief agency, were let go early today after their abduction last night. Authorities in Cyprus say they have not received any requests for release of prisoners. President Bush and West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl spoke by telephone today, but apparently made no progress toward resolving the dispute over short-range missiles in Europe. The Bonn government wants the U.S. to open talks with the Soviet Union to reduce the number of missiles, which are for the most part stationed on German soil. The Bush administration opposes such talks as long as the Soviet Union holds an advantage in conventional weapons. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, meanwhile, charged the Soviet Union is working, quote, assiduously to try to divide NATO. Stock prices were lower in mixed trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 3 points today to close at 2381.96. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singer and piano player Marsha Ball from Austin, Texas, was passing through here recently, and we invited her to play a couple of her songs for our weekly performance spot. They're both about love. One's a boogie-woogie, but this first one's a ballad called The Power of Love.
I believe that it's a miracle that I found you and made you mine, and it's a miracle how love can grow so much in so little time. I wrote this next song some years ago, and I generally introduce it by saying that I can't remember who I wrote it about. The ironic part is this song is called I Love One Man. My mind's made up. He just too much. blessings every day. And everybody says I'm just being foolish and stubborn, but my mind made up. Well, now don't waste your energy telling me about all the other fishes in the sea, 'cause I love my baby and my mind's made up. Now he's just too much and stubborn, but my mind made up. Yeah, he's my baby and my mind made up. Ooh, you don't have to try to make me change my mind. He's so fine, I'm never gonna let him go. He's my baby, I know I really love him and my mind made up.
Marsha Ball and her band have a new album out on Rounder Records called Gator Rhythms. This is Fresh Air. Years before Harry Anderson became a judge on TV's Night Court, he was a con man, magician, and street performer. In his new book, Games You Can't Lose, A Guide for Suckers, Anderson reveals the secrets behind some of his favorite con games. I had read that when Anderson was a street performer in San Francisco, he chopped off his hand, so I asked him to tell me how he created the illusion. He said that when he was working the streets, he heard that his European counterparts were making a lot of money playing to people waiting on movie lines. He worked up a particularly gory act, which he thought would appeal to people waiting in line to see Jaws. Here's how he prepared to chop off his hand.
What you do is you buy a phony hand at the magic shop, and you get a loaf of French bread, and you hollow out one end of the French bread, and you stick the phony hand in there. It's a baguette, a long loaf. About the diameter of an arm. And then in the other end, you take a turkey baster and you fill it with stage blood and you stick that in the other end. Then you take an old shirt, you cut the sleeve off, and you put that around the bread. Now, standing at my table, and on the street I used to wear this big robe, I would reach over with one hand and get this ugly-looking cleaver, and at the same time, using that distraction, I would grab this phony hand and pull my arm up into the robe, bring the phony hand down on the table, bring the meat cleaver through the bread, and a cleaver going through crunchy French bread really does, if you think you're going through somebody's arm, does give you the sound of gristle and bone. It's remarkable. Then I would hit this turkey baster a couple of times, and the stage blood would go everywhere, and it was sensational. And I thought, this is gonna kill him. So I did it once. I got it all set, went out there, did it once. The crowd absolutely freaked out, turned on me. A guy came up and punched me in the face. And I didn't do it anymore.
They must have thought you were psychotic.
Well, they were waiting to see Jaws. I mean, I thought I was playing the crowd. They didn't throw a lot of money at me, no.
Is there a lesson in this about how extreme you can get?
You can't get that extreme, I think. That's the lesson.
Did you ever run real swindles before it actually became an act?
Did I run real swindles? Oh, yeah. I mean, I started as a... On the street, I did not begin as a performer. I began running the shell game. And, again, another experience with a dissatisfied customer who decided that I was not playing a game of chance. And that was another punch. Broke my jaw. Got me sitting down and wondering if there was an easier way to make a living. What I did was I took the stuff I knew, which was essentially cheating at cards and picking locks and running the shell game, and turned it into an act and made less money initially, but I had a better chance at survival. And then I've just been in the process of becoming more and more legitimate through the years, and now I'm a judge. Who would have thought?
So how did you learn to pick locks and run a shell game?
Well, it was the stuff that fascinated me. When I was a kid in Chicago, I hung around a place called the Ambassador Hotel, and they had a room there called the Pump Room. And that's where the old guys would come and play cards. And my dad was a salesman, and I don't recall exactly why I was spending afternoons there, but I do recall watching these old guys play cards. And Chicago is a big town for magicians and card hustlers. So when I was very young, a fellow sat me down and taught me the three-card Monty. And that kind of put me in a, pointed me towards easy money. And I just learned what I could to become what they call a wise guy. Unfortunately, that was the early 50s, and the day of the wise guy was really ending. The day of the street entrepreneur was kind of vanishing. They flourished in the post-war era. But then, fortunately, the history of it overlapped neatly with street performers who made a comeback in the 60s when I was a teenager. And so I was able to step right into that.
So you learned how to do shell games. You also learned how to pick locks. Did you use that to rob people?
Oh, no. No, I didn't. Really, my only run-ins with the law were over hustling on the street. I did get busted once in New Orleans for a couple of nights for and the irony was that was after I had stopped actually hustling with the shell game and was doing it as a kind of a bunco demonstration.
What was your rap when you were running the shell game?
Little game of hanky poo, two for me and one for you. Hey diddle diddle, it's the one in the middle. Which one is it now? And on as the game required.
So how were you discovered after playing the streets and then playing casinos? How did you make it onto television?
Well, it all happened kind of quick. I was in town with my wife. She was raised in Los Angeles, and we were in town visiting her folks and playing the Magic Castle, which is a nightclub for magicians here in town. And I was doing my act, which at that time consisted of a stage version of the three-card Monty and the demonstration of the holdout. And Kenny Rogers' manager, Ken Cragen, saw me, and at that time, Kenny's big song was The Gambler. And he thought that my material was very appropriate to go along with Kenny's hit, and he asked me to open for Kenny in Las Vegas, which I did, and I was seen there, asked to do Saturday Night Live, which I did 9 or 10 times over the years. The Charles Brothers had a new show. Glenn and Les Charles had a new show in mind called Cheers, and they thought that a con man would be a very natural character in the bar. So they hired me to do the first season of Cheers, and somebody saw me on Cheers and thought that I was an actor playing a part as opposed to a guy just doing what he knew, and they gave me night court. And by the time they realized I wasn't an actor, I had already signed a 5-year contract. Joke's on them.
Do you think of yourself as having used any cons to get your role on night court?
Well, I based on that story, I'd say that's exactly how I did it. I mean, it was a little inadvertent, but it was by playing a con man. I mean, I hadn't acted, I hadn't taken lessons, and I hadn't auditioned. I had simply done what I knew, and that led to playing Judge Harry Stone.
I've got one last question for you.
What?
Okay, now that you're...
What are you, a cop? You got a lot of questions, you know that?
Now that you're really recognizable because of all of your work on television, does this mean that you can't take a train and play cards anymore? I mean, you couldn't even have fun running a game somewhere.
You know, that's one of the things I really miss. I used to make my living by understanding people, and the way I learned to understand them was by observing them. I would sit in a train station or a bus station or a restaurant, and I would watch people. I would watch how they related to one another. I would try to get some insight into them and make them as predictable as I could in my mind. And it was what I guess I felt was my job, but at the same time, it was very enjoyable. I love people. I love their mannerisms and their eccentricities. And now it's very difficult for me to anonymously sit back and watch. I tend to hide at the airport, and especially if I'm with my family, just so that we can have a little quiet time. But what I do miss is that that observation time. I used to rely on anonymity. That was one of my tools, was the fact that I could go from one town to another and that I wasn't known. Now that has really turned around 180 degrees. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, I'm not complaining about, I don't mean to sound as if I'm complaining about my success. It beats putting on an orange vest and picking up shit off the freeway, you know. But there are things that I miss.
Do you miss being able to run a good card game?
Oh, I still play cards. Uh-huh. But now I cheat my wife at cards, you know, with no money. Now she's going to hear this, and she's never going to play cards with me again.
Well, Harry Anderson, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm glad we finally did.
Harry Anderson writes about con games in his new book, Games You Can't Lose, A Guide for Suckers. And he plays Judge Harry Stone on TV's Night Court. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. How are you? We'll be following the new unemployment figures, what's to become of the Iran-Contra prosecutions after the conviction of Oliver North on 3 counts. We'll also be hearing from the research ship Jason, that's in the Mediterranean. You know, they've been probing underwater with the robots and sending pictures up via satellite. Have you followed this at all?
Yes, we have.
They found vents under the ocean floor and some very interesting life forms that they didn't know were there before. Also, we'll be host to Kate and Anna McGarrigle, singers from Quebec. And we'll be talking with Ken Ringel, who wrote a story in the Washington Post yesterday about a Capitol Hill aide who some years ago committed a very violent assault on a woman.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During World War II, the entertainment industry rallied its talent in support of the war effort. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new home video that features some of the more animated characters that got into the act.
There are lots of cassette cartoon collections around, but for the most part, they're random gatherings aimed at undiscriminating children or adults looking for a hit of instant nostalgia. But as its title suggests, Bugs and Daffy, the wartime cartoons, is something different. This tape offers 11 Warner Brothers cartoons made in the 40s, just before and during World War II. Intended as propaganda, these cartoons communicate derision, impudence, and aggressive bad taste. They are, in short, wonderful. That's Mel Blanc doing an impersonation of Adolf Hitler in a cartoon called Russian Rhapsody. Midway through that speech, a sign appears on the screen that reads, "Silly, isn't he?" What strikes you about these cartoons, aside from the brilliantly casual artistry of their animation, is that unlike the dramas and musicals made during this period, cartoons were free to be something more than flag-waving morale boosters. Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck could enact the fear and contempt people felt for Hitler. Cartoon directors such as Chuck Jones, Bob Clampett, and the anarchic Frank Tashlin were let loose, their ids were uncorked, and they came up with stuff like Hada Mari, a German spy who lifts her skirt to reveal a swastika sewn to her garter belt. It's tasteless and sexy and scary all at the same time. In a cartoon called Drafty Daffy, our favorite duck scans the morning paper for the news of the day and then breaks into song.
U.S. Army announces a smashing frontal attack on enemy rear. A smashing frontal attack on enemy rear? Hooray! Oh, hooray for the red, white, and blue! Oh, hooray for the red, white, and blue! A Yankee Doodle went to town riding on a pony, like Teddy did at San Juan Hill, and this is no baloney. If I could be with you 1 hour tonight, if I was there to do the things I might.
There are a lot of good new video cassette releases around just now. There's Eight Men Out, director John Sayles' baseball movie about the Black Sox scandal of 1919. Sayles takes his history so seriously that he impedes a lot of the baseball action, but it must be a good movie because I couldn't care less about our national pastime and I was still caught up in the story. And there's Tucker, The Man and His Dream. No, it's not the story of my life. It's the story of pioneering automobile maker Preston Tucker. It stars Jeff Bridges in the title role, Martin Landau snagged an Oscar nomination for his work, and the film was directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Robert Pinsky is a literary critic who mistrusts literary criticism. He's also a poet, and on the next Fresh Air, he reads a poem about growing up in a small town on the Jersey Shore and explains how he came to think of himself as the curator of the past. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new recording by German bassist Eberhard Weber. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the CBS movie Murder by Moonlight. It's a murder mystery set on the moon. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Mark Vogelzang. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.